County Government involved. There was a referendum in 1974, an in-out referendum, sorry, there was a referendum following the 1974 election, an in-out referendum in which the British people were asked whether they wanted to stay in the European community, and of 65% turnout, 17.3 million said yes. What happens after that is rather interesting. At the end of the 1970s, Mrs. Thatcher comes to...
At the end of the 1970s, Mrs. Thatcher comes to power. She's initially pro-European. She campaigned for a yes vote in the referendum. She negotiated the Single European Act and played a large role in Europe until the very end of her period in office, the late 1980s through to her removal in 1990, when we see a transition, a significant transition in the Conservative Party and the growth of a group of Eurosceptic MPs. Eurosceptic MPs who start off hostile to the ratification of the Treaty of Maastricht, which was driven through Parliament by Mrs. Thatcher's successor, John Major. And John Major's 7 years at the end of a long period of Conservative rule, his 7 years in government, one full term plus 2 years succeeding Mrs. Thatcher, was characterized by almost a civil war within the British Conservative Party focused on Europe. So the Conservative Party had moved from being pro-Europe to being riven by the problem of Europe, with a very significant number of Conservative MPs, factions within the party becoming profoundly anti-Europe and using hostility to the European Union almost as a defining characteristic of what it is to be a Conservative politician. So a young potential candidate wanting to get a safe seat would have to be a Eurosceptic. Right. Conservatives are defeated in 1997. Tony Blair leads a Labour government, a new Labour government from 1997 through till 2007, the last 3 years under Gordon Brown up to 2010. See a Labour Party that has completely transformed itself from being anti-Europe to being pro or comfortable with Europe. There remain one or two anti-European MPs in the Labour Party, but their voice is insignificant. Nobody really pays any attention to Eurosceptics within the Labour Party. It is the pro-European party. Now, some of that is to do with the transformation of European policy in the 80s and 90s under Jacques Delors and the social dimension to European policy, which is attractive to Labour and also a cause for concern amongst economic liberal conservatives, but it's also a process of the party changing radically in its self-understanding. That's the context. So what then happens is throughout the period of Blair's time as Prime Minister, he is the most successful Labour Prime Minister in terms of election winning significant majorities, even in 2005, following the Iraq War, when there was a lot of hostility amongst his own electorate, he was still able to return leading a majority government. Successive Conservative opposition leaders who had become tougher and more Eurosceptic in their stance continued to lose elections. So in 2005, following the defeat of the third of John Major's successors, Michael Howard, there's a leadership election. David Cameron becomes the leader of the Conservative Party. And the first thing that Cameron tries to do is to change the subject. So we have the transformation of conservatism with environmentalism, making various kinds of concessions on social policy, and the adoption of a sort of social liberalism alongside their economic liberalism, as the defining features of conservatism. And this is characterized by ideas like the big society, which was a phrase that no one really understood what it meant, but it was used by Cameron in a certain kind of way. He was often criticized for this, but the crucial point about talking about the big society was to try and find something to talk about, a political discourse that did not mention Europe. So the task of Cameron leading up to the formation of the coalition government in 2010 is to have a conservative policy, a conservative narrative or ideology which does not mention Europe, because it's such a divisive subject. One of the curious advantages of this big society conversation is when, after the 2010 election, the Conservatives don't win a majority. They are the largest single party, but are required to form a coalition government. And they form a coalition government with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party, the Liberal Democratic Party, was always seen to be a centre-left party. Its natural bedfellows or potential coalition would be with the Labour Party. And yet the Liberal Democrats form a coalition with the Conservatives. Now, some of that is explained partly because of the electoral arithmetic. At the time of the economic crisis, stability is the important thing that the government brings. The electoral arithmetic wouldn't have allowed for a stable government that was made up of a multi-party coalition. So it would just about have been possible for the Labour Party to form a multi-party coalition with Liberal Democrats, Nationalists, the one Green MP, and so on. But it would have been so politically unstable, it would have had dire economic consequences. So the electoral logic forces the Liberals and the Conservatives together. But there's also something in Cameron's transformation of conservatism. Cameron describes himself famously in a 2007 speech as a liberal conservative. Liberal in social issues, but alongside. So he's trying to reposition the party to converge on the share of the vote that is the Liberal vote. And the consequence is a coalition that in some levels is rather successful. It's successful because it's successful not least because it was formed very, very quickly. A full coalition document for government was agreed within a few days. The coalition launched itself with a certain amount of enthusiasm, and it began its primary task, which was to deal with the economic issues of the day. Right? It has effectively one policy, which is deficit reduction and austerity. Everything else is more or less irrelevant in terms of its policy. In that respect, Europe too is really marginalized. And Europe itself has had its own concerns, its own internal concerns with the management of the Eurozone. So we're not part of the Eurozone. Eurozone is the preoccupation of much of Europe, bailing out the South, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, Brendan in the background signaling, yes, them too. Greece, continually a problem, Cyprus most recently. Nothing much is happening that is going to draw in the attention of the UK coalition government. Okay? There's no real treaty renegotiations or all the things that sort of raise the European issue in British politics. But at the same time, despite convergence at the top of the government, a sort of likeness of mind amongst the key leadership of the coalition, there starts to appear a preoccupation in British politics with Europe and an in-out referendum and worry about the demands of Europe on British politics, which haven't changed significantly. but they suddenly arise. Now, the issue is, why is that? And my suggestion is that there are a number of reasons. Firstly, a coalition government brings with it the problem of two parties coming together, having to share office and share the benefits of government. So ministerial offices are now shared between the party that had hoped to be the main government, the single-party government, and had effectively failed to achieve that. So they've lost, in a sense. They haven't won what they wanted. And the Liberal Democrats, who had never really hoped to be in government at all, finding that they have the opportunity for ministerial office. So this creates a lot of disgruntlement on the backbenches, people who see their careers effectively frustrated because of the requirements of coalition. Now, the worry for those backbenchers is that the coalition is going to run on for the full term to 2015, and if the Conservatives are successful, a whole new generation of MPs will be elected who will want ministerial office, so the backbenchers who haven't got ministerial office this time around will be passed over by new talent coming in, or they lose, in which case their chances of political career are reduced again. So there's pressures from the backbenches on the coalition leadership, the cabinet, Cameron in particular. But given that the Liberal Democrats have committed themselves to a policy of deficit reduction, of austerity, which is much, much more demanding than anything that Mrs. Thatcher attempted in terms of rolling back the welfare state or downsizing the impact of government on the economy, they don't have that as the grounds for objecting to the direction of the coalition. So instead, Europe becomes the test. Europe becomes the test of an authentic conservative voice within the coalition, because it's the one thing that divides the Liberal Democrats, who are traditionally pro-Europe, and the Conservatives, who, as I say, have become Eurosceptic. So we have this rise of Euroscepticism simply because of the needs of the Conservative Party to differentiate itself from its Liberal coalition partners. Again, wholly domestic concerns. This is not because of anything that Europe is doing. This is simply because of the internal dynamics of British electoral policy. And the justification for this focus on differentiation is the impact of this third rather curious party called the United Kingdom Independence Party. Now, they're worth a mention only because they were founded by an LSE professor who may at some stage come and speak to you, Alan Sked. I don't know if any of you whilst at the school. And Sked was involved in a cross-party campaign against the Maastricht Treaty in the early 90s. And he set up this group, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which was to campaign for leaving the European Union. Now, Sked resigned. Sked, when he resigned from the leadership of the United Kingdom Independence Party, he said it was because they were dominated by racists and the extreme right, so he wanted to sort of shed his connections with them. And that idea is picked up in famous criticism of the United Kingdom Independence Party by David Cameron, who says that he describes them as fruitcakes, loonies, and closet racists. So there's real hostility between the leaders of the UK Independence Party and David Cameron. Now, UKIP are, as they're called, United Kingdom Independence Party, acronym UKIP, they're always known as, are a curious party because their base is tiny, their electoral base is tiny, their share of the vote is significant enough to damage but not significant enough to win elections. But they managed to achieve enormous public voice in British politics. They are courted by a certain section of the press. They have representation rights in the media because of their success in the one proportional election that we actually have in the UK, which is for the European Parliament, and the European Parliament, in the elections of 2009, they achieved they achieved 15% of the vote and got 11 of the 79 European Parliament seats, which they then took because the European Parliament pays a lot. So this is a party that's virulently anti-Europe, largely being funded and supported by the voice that the European Union gives them, okay, to support their campaigns and so on. Now, UKIP are very good at campaigning. We've recently had a local by-election in Eastleigh, in the southern part of England, brought about by one of the cabinet members, the Liberal Democrat cabinet members in the coalition government, are going to prison for perverting the course of justice. This caused a snap general election, and within that, UKIP did rather well. And that creates fear amongst the Conservatives that their long-term position is going to be undermined. Now, lots of Conservative Party members then see UKIP as being the true voice of hostility to Europe, and that again encourages parliamentary backbenchers to adopt an ever more strident line in terms of its policy towards Europe. So they just, although again there's no pressure from outside, the tone of debate within British politics about Europe gets more and more accelerated and strident. And that creates real problems for Cameron. That creates real problems for the European, for the UK coalition government. It creates, and this is leading to my conclusion, it creates problems for the coalition government because when one does analysis of the interests or the electoral priorities of the UK Independence Party, it turns out that their primary, the primary issue that voters identify when saying why they chose UK Independence Party is not leaving Europe, it's immigration. So the UK Independence Party has become a kind of populist, anti-politician party that covers the usual fears of people in times of austerity about too many foreigners taking our jobs and so on and so forth. And that's why they attract electoral support. Now that's a very, very difficult issue for any party to compete on. Because if the fear is too much immigration, we're being swamped by foreigners taking our jobs, that fear is easy to accelerate and so on, but it's very difficult to deal with in terms of policy. Because no matter what the Conservatives, the Labour opposition, the Liberal Democrats do to say they're dealing with fears about immigration, it will never be enough for those who think there are too many immigrants. So in one sense, Cameron is now caught by this policy agenda, which has nothing to do with Europe, which he cannot compete on, despite now having committed himself to offering an in-out referendum by 2017 if he wins the next election, because he's being pushed by a party that says it's about the independence of Britain from the European Union, but is really concerned with other issues on which there is nothing he can do to outpace them. So that leads me to my conclusion. Okay, the future of the coalition government in the face of this aspect of the spectre of Europe. Negotiations with European partners that Cameron might want to enter into, which are an important part of setting up the in-out referendum question for 2017, are unlikely to succeed. They're unlikely to succeed because even if he is successful in the process of negotiation with European partners, and there is a certain amount of goodwill in Europe to try and accommodate British interests, the expectations of his own party are so high that any real achievements will be insufficient to satisfy them, because they're trying to deal with something else completely. There's no agreement he can get from Europe that will satisfy those people. UK Independence Party, on the other hand, is a serious threat to all three political parties. It can take their votes, but it's never going to win significantly. And given that outside of a proportional system, outside of the European elections, the elections for the European Parliament, we have a first-past-the-post system, they will never get representation in the UK Parliament. They can take votes, they can wound, but they can never really kill. So they again present Cameron with a problem that he can't dispense with them completely, but he has to be aware that they could deny him office. What does he do? He's going to be placed in the same position that John Major was placed in the early 1990s, having to choose between his party and the electoral best interest and the best interests of the country. Cameron is also aware that were the Conservative Party to become a genuinely anti-European party, finance and support would just flow back to the opposition. That would be the end of the Conservative Party. He knows that the city would cease to back the Conservative Party, and the Conservative Party would essentially cease to be a major electoral force. So the electoral damage of UKIP will affect all parties, but it's most likely going to result in the failure of Cameron in his aspiration to achieve a single Conservative Party government post 2015. In all probability, we're faced with another coalition government, but a coalition government that will feature the Liberal Democrats but will not be led by the Conservative Party. And finally, although it's always risky to say never, because never is a very, very long time in politics, my final prediction is that the Conservative Party will not form a viable government, a viable majority government again, until it is able to deal with the place, its reconciliation of the place of Europe in British politics. So Cameron needs to learn the lesson of his otherwise hero, Tony Blair, in transforming the Conservative Party if they are ever to achieve majority government status again. So, thank you. That was...
Okay, I'll have to say for 10 minutes.
Well, I'm glad that Paul ended on a good note. The Conservative Party might disappear. It's the best piece of news I've heard in a long time. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you. You didn't quite predict that. I agree with Paul, of course, on all things. After all, he's one of the senior figures around the LSE. And as we learn in the world, there are two people you always obey, your wife or your husband and your boss. So I do agree with him. I would put it a little bit more strongly, though, on just picking up on what Paul said there. I'm not sure the British people, whoever they are, actually have ever been sold psychologically on Europe. I agree with you on the domestic aspects and the politics of it, but the British are a very odd lot, very peculiar people altogether. And I think there's always been a Euroscepticism in Britain. We've never been sold on it. I'm just jotting down a few reasons why. Firstly, the British feel psychologically closer to Australia than they do to Holland. They feel psychologically closer to Hong Kong than Germany. My father, who is a very rare creature, a working-class guy who read history, said, "I like foreigners as long as they stay in their own countries. And if they're French and Germans, will they please stay away?" There has been a very long and peculiar and conflictual relationship, let's be clear, between Britain and France, which goes back a very long time, 1066. Our friends in China can understand that sense of history. And the Napoleonic Wars are still of recent memory. The French, of course, are the source of many of the worst British jokes, and some of the best. And of course, there were two small wars against Germany. We still play those wars. It's called football. So, for all sorts of odd reasons, and it also has something to do with British imperial history. Britain was an empire, and therefore its interests fundamentally lay outside of Europe. As Mrs. Thatcher once put it, we only have to go back into Europe to stop those silly foreigners doing silly things to one another. And then we'll get on with the real purpose of Britain, which is essentially to be an imperial power. In some sense, if you still look at British interests in the world, it's still that legacy, and I still think that's been part of it. And that legacy, of course, continued after the war in terms of the special relationship. You know, British people, the Brits, generally felt closer to the Americans than they did to their French friends 22 miles away, or to Germans or Italians. So it's a very kind of peculiar, long-term, more complicated set of relations, I think. And I think what you say is absolutely true. It's become more acute now. The domestic side of that has made it more so. But I think it's something deeper, which runs through the veins of the British. There was also an ideological dimension to this, and it was made more real by Thatcher. I mean, for Thatcher, it was a genuine free marketeer. The British and the Americans did free markets. The Europeans did kind of state-led dirigiste politics. There was a kind of an ideological divide as much as there was the 22 miles of the channel. And I think that's reinforced all that. And many of the problems that Cameron faces today, of course, are the legacy of Mrs. Thatcher and all that goes into it. So I agree entirely with Paul that there's a very strong domestic political aspect to all this. And I think the Conservatives have got themselves into all sorts of difficulties and troubles, as Paul has pointed out, which may indeed one day lead to their disappearance, though I doubt that. But nonetheless, I think it taps into a wider Euroscepticism, which I think has been there both on the left, less so now, and certainly in the Conservative Party. The only really openly pro-European party, really pro-European, has been the Liberal Democrats in British political life, consistently over time. Remember, if you go back to the 1970s, the Labour Party actually was quite hostile to even joining the European Union. So I think there's a wider issue here. This is very odd, however, and as Paul points out at the very end there, it's extraordinarily odd. I mean, first of all, Europe is now, although most British people don't know this, indeed they don't know it very much, it's Britain's major trading partner. And not so many British people know that, actually. Secondly, the City of London, as Paul pointed out, the City of London would no longer be the City of London if Britain was ever to leave the European Union. What is interestingly, is actually how few industrialists and people from the city will very openly fight for Europe politically. They kind of say it too quietly, but they don't fight for it politically, which kind of tells you again about public opinion in Britain and this kind of sense that it's a very fragile public opinion. The other thing which is very odd about this, in the sense of talking as an international relations scholar, we talk in international relations about something called a national interest. And obviously one of the British great national interests, of course, is Britain is, for all sorts of interesting historical reasons, language, its openness, globalization. Britain has always been very attractive to foreign capital. Foreign direct investment is, in a sense, one of the major sources of the British economy. We talk about the City of London, when in fact the largest majority of people now working in the City of London are not British. Most of the banks are not British-owned. Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, originally, as you know, didn't come from London. work out where it came from, largest bank in the world. Britain has always, therefore, seen itself as part of a global economy. London was always an imperial city. It was never actually really properly part of Britain. It always looked outwards to the world rather than northwards to places like Manchester and Birmingham. So it's always been attractive to foreign direct investment. Now, if this particular government had the bad luck to set a referendum which then took Britain out of the European Union, that would mean a massive decline in foreign direct investment. into the United Kingdom. Because one of the reasons why foreign companies from this part of the world and certainly from the United States come to the UK is quite simple. Because Britain is a member of the European Union. And once you're in Britain, you simply then, you've got a base within inside the Union itself. So everything Paul says I agree with, but I do think firstly there's a wider problem. And I think secondly, the consequences, the actual consequences for Britain of ever contemplating or indeed moving towards a distant or even a departing from the European Union would actually be disastrous in terms of British national interest, quite simply. Now, Brendan gave me the small job of talking about the pivot to Asia, the world, the transatlantic relationship, British Premier League, and a few other things as well. I'll only talk on seven of those issues. One of the things which has, of course, accelerated this debate in Britain, as Paul points out, there are two other reasons, I think, why I think this debate has reached an acute phase in Britain. And maybe it's not just reaching an acute phase in Britain either. This is not a peculiarly British problem about worrying about Europe. There's a debate going on throughout Europe about Europe. If you like, there's more Euroscepticism in Europe than there's ever been before. And so it's not just, therefore, a peculiarly British issue, although I think there are very strong peculiarities of the British debate, as Paul points out. I mean, quite obviously, the first reason for the acuteness of the current debate is the euro crisis. I mean, when Europe was doing well economically, when growth was going up, when Ireland was a little tiger, Celtic tiger, as Brendan knows, when Iceland was a superpower economically, when Cyprus was the place that people wanted to put their money, and when Greece seemed relatively economically stable, and Spain was growing and growing and growing, and Portugal looked like a good place to dump your money, legal or otherwise, Europe looked on the up. Europe does not look on the up now. So the euro crisis has reinforced the euroscepticism, which is playing so much into the debate within the Conservative Party. They're tapping into some, we told you so. We didn't join this damn silly euro with this very unattractive banknote. We kept our pound, and were we proud and clever to have done so? There's a lot of schadenfreude. There's a lot of kind of we did well, but the euro crisis has undoubtedly accelerated this problem in the British context. But I think there's an even deeper problem, which brings me then to the world, and it's this. And you see this very much in Cameron's speeches, I think, Paul, and certainly in the speeches of the Foreign Secretary, Hague, who was a very bright and able man, by the way. He's no fool, not in the least, nor indeed, of course, Cameron. But when you read the speeches of Cameron and Hague, what do they talk about? Forgetting the European thing. The way they look at the world now, it seems to me, is quite interesting. And, of course, I think it talks to many of you in this audience. The world is changing. The world is shifting. The rise of the BRICS, the rise of Asia, the emergence of China, the rise of India, that's where the future lies. That's the new world emerging. A few speeches by Cameron is almost as if an old world, which is Europe, declining, fossilized, too many pensions, social welfare nets, all that kind of stuff. All the things that are, in a sense, making Europe a declining part of the world. And there, out there, Asia, people like you, forceful, thrusting, dynamic, competitive, the 21st century. So in a sense, what is also reinforced, and you see this, I mean, after all, recently you may have noticed David Cameron led a large delegation, including our own director, Craig Calhoun, and a dozen vice chancellors, and leaders of British universities. Now, where did they go to? Well, I tell you, they didn't go to Athens. They weren't on the sails pushed to Berlin. They didn't go down to Lisbon. And they weren't in Nicosia. Where did they go? Off to India. Yeah, and in the speech to Haig, he talks in this way, as indeed does President Obama, that the new world arising is somewhere else, and it ain't in Europe. Europe is the old world. It's the declining world. It's the world which may have made the world for 500 years. Its days are more or less over. We've got to therefore look way beyond Europe to rethink both Britain's position in the world, and indeed think that this Europe, this experiment, is at least facing some fundamental structural problems. Look elsewhere. What I want to suggest briefly, and relatively quickly, that in this new Eurosceptical period we are now living through, and I meet it everywhere, by the way. I meet it everywhere. I've just been over in the United States. Well, the first question is, where is Europe? Because, you know, Americans are not very good at geography. And if you're in San Francisco, Europe is even further away, let me tell you. But it's a kind of an extraordinary thing. When I go to the States and I talk to people in the foreign policy community, the story is quite similar about Europe. There's a certain Euroscepticism there, too. Certain Euroscepticism there in the United States. They don't do enough, Europeans don't spend enough on security. Out in Afghanistan, it's Americans doing most of the fighting. You saw today the death of five American personnel, State Department military people. Europeans really can't fight. Europeans don't even spend much on defense. In fact, the best form of European defense is saying, I surrender. European defense expenditures are going down. And at the same time, you've got this European economic crisis. So there's quite a lot of Euroscepticism, not just in Britain or in the Conservative Party, and not just in Europe, but also across the Atlantic in the United States of America. And I think I pick up some of that, too, in Asia. You know, European Union was a good model of integration vis-a-vis the ASEAN. Now is it such a great model to follow, given that integration is running into all sorts of problems within Europe? So the skepticism is everywhere. I know in China, too, I follow the debates in China. Many criticisms of the European Union on a range of issues, whether China is a full market economy, human rights, arms sales. But that has got stronger more recently, I feel. So I think the skepticism actually is more global than it is just peculiarly British. Now, I want to make a couple of broad points. Firstly, in this new neuro-skeptical age in which we seem to be living, for all sorts of good reasons, the euro crisis is real. Young people of the age of 25 have a 25% chance of being unemployed. You know, levels of emigration out of Europe now are growing. Interestingly, one of the biggest points of emigration now for people from Spain is Latin America, and from people from Portugal to Brazil. There's now more money flowing back, remittances from Brazil and Argentina back to Portugal and back to Spain than is going there. It tells you something about the very real problems which exist. I suppose really what I want to make the case, it's two big questions. First, it's very easy in this environment to underestimate Europe's structural strengths. There's so much kind of downplaying of Europe's strengths and so much upplaying of its problems. It is very easy to forget some of those pretty obvious strengths which have been built up over a period of 30 or 40 years, and certainly since the end of the Cold War in 1989. It is still the largest market in the world, whatever anybody says. I mean, still 500 million pretty well-off consumers. By the way, it's still China's largest trading partner. It's a bigger trading partner than the United States. Please remember that. Americans don't know that. I love America, by the way, so my jokes are all meant in good humor. Of course, the British, you know, are very funny people. Secondly, Europe actually has what two of the largest financial centres in the world. One is still called London, and one is still called Frankfurt. It still carries two of the most major currencies in the world. The euro is still a major trading currency in the world, whatever the problems are internal to Europe. And the pound, although it's not the major currency in the world, still represents about 5 to 6 to 7% of global financing. So they're not insignificant. Some of the most advanced corporations are still located, would you believe, in Europe. For anybody who gets very wealthy in China, what do you buy? Well, the first thing you buy normally is a German car. I once said to a friend of mine when I was in Hong Kong that if ever I was to die in China, it would be because of a driver in Hong Kong knocking me over with the newest Mercedes-Benz. In other words, I mean, there's a lot of really good corporations in Europe. Again, one forgets that because the emphasis on Cyprus's problems, unemployment in Spain, social strains, and all the rest of it. Dare I also say Europe's a pretty good model of regional cooperation. One of the huge issues that Asia faces overall is, of course, a degree of a lack of trust. Weak regional institutions. We all know this. It's not to blame one country or another, or to say it's Japan's fault or China's fault or Vietnam's fault, but weak regional institutions are one of the real problems in Asia and remain so, in my opinion. And there's still, therefore, it seems to me, much to be learned. I mean, if you're right, Europe has been a fantastic peace project. And again, that needs to be, we need to be reminded of the huge transformations that have been brought about as a result of the European project. And I'll also make one final point on some of the strength on universities. I mean, you're all interested in university education. You all have some connection with the London School of Economics. Last October, the Times Higher Education, THE, which comes out of Britain, published a league table of 500 leading universities in the world. And I was really quite interested in this league table for a very obvious reason, that there was a fantastic lack of connection between the empirical evidence and the headlines. The headlines said Western universities in decline, Asian universities on the rise. Now, I think there's been a huge improvement and transformation in Asian universities in this country as elsewhere. But actually, when I went down the statistics, something really odd happened to me. Hold on, I said. 47 top universities in the world are American. Oh, hold on. This doesn't look like a tilt to Asia. Then I saw there were 17 UK. Ooh. Then some French universities are pretty good. And the Germans. And the Dutch. And the Norwegians, and the Scandinavians. In other words, when I started adding, I don't really do statistics, believe me. I generally ignore facts, as you've heard here this evening. Ignoring facts makes tell a better story. But I found out that 89 of the top universities in the world are based in Western Europe and the United States, including Canada and a bit of Australia. So 40% of the top universities in the world are still based in Europe, and one of those, of course, is called the London School of Economics. So, in this Eurosceptical age, it's very important for people around the world to understand what the strengths of Europe, and indeed, coming back to our question on the UK, still are. But it's easy to underestimate, and I don't say that as a European chauvinist or a British kind of mad patriot. I'm neither, but nonetheless, it is important to say all of that. There is a problem, though, and I'll end with a problem, or at least with a question. It does seem to me, however, that Europe faces two big questions to which so far, and this is equally true of Britain, as part of Europe. We always say Britain and Europe. Don't you find that strange? Britain and Europe, you know. But I think there's a double problem here, a double whammy, if you wish. One is getting through this crisis is going to be no easy matter. And by the way, this crisis will hurt you just as much as it will hurt other people. It will. I mean, your exports have fallen. You know, the consequences of a continuing European crisis knocks on around the world. So our problem is your problem, okay? Like your problems are our problems too. So we live in that interdependent world, and that's for sure. So getting out of this crisis, first and foremost, is absolutely essential. It's going to take a long, long time to get out of it. And then secondly, I think Europe has to find a role for itself, define what its role is. in the world. You know, that seems to be a much bigger problem to do. The one thing I would say, it shouldn't be like America. Europe doesn't do aircraft carriers. You know, it doesn't do F-111s. It doesn't do that kind of power. It has those capabilities, but that's not what it does. And it seems to me it's got to find out what its role is. And I don't think thus far it has found an answer to that. It's not prepared to spend more on security. It has great economic capacity, but much of that is, I think, partly dissipated for a failure of institutions. I would, in the end, argue, and I push the argument much stronger than I think many people would in Britain, that Europe is still unfinished business. I think it faces a choice. It either fragments or it goes towards further integration. I don't think there's any option here. This is where I get back to your point, Paul. This is where I think the Tories have a real problem in Britain. Because the solution, or at least the potential solution for Europe, is either one of further fragmentation, which is a real possibility, with all the costs and consequences that would bring with it, or further integration. And in the process of doing that, finding for itself some kind of wider role in a world which is still going to be dominated by the United States, and in a world in which China and Asia will be playing more and more role. And they'll be looking to Europe, not just the specific small countries like Britain or France or even Germany. They'll be looking to Europe. Until Europe finds an answer to that dilemma, Europe will continue in the current crisis. Thank you very much indeed.
Do you want us to have some aircraft carriers?
Well, I was just going to say, I
was waiting for question time, but we want to have a conversation and everyone can watch you.
Please,
if there are questions from the floor, please go ahead.
My name's Doc, he's Kelly.
I'm quite interested in when you talk about the city of London, etc. And then especially, I was wondering what do you think the city of London play in the United Kingdom? And would I be able to ask you, are you a British or are you a Londoner? How would you define yourself?
I'll sing the song. Well, okay, the answer to the quick one, actually, is my parents came from London. Oh, sorry, my parents came from London. Can you hear me at the back? Wave your hands, can you hear them? Thank you. My parents came from London, but actually I had the rare privilege of doing what most British people never do. I lived for 5 years in Scotland, 20 years in Ireland, and 7 years in Wales. So I am a true Brit. You know, I'm a genuine Brit. I'm a hybrid. My mother was Irish, my father was British, and my grandmother was Jewish. You know, I'm a mongrel. Which actually, I mean, Britain is an immigrant country. Paul raised this question of immigration. Why do British get so hung up about immigration? I just don't understand. We're all damned immigrants in Britain, basically. I mean, actually, the French started it in 1066. The British were then run by the Welsh. They were called the Tudors. We've got everybody, and Germans, you know. So, that's my background. I think I'm pretty typical in that, very hybrid. City of London, I'll just say one point, it's an extraordinarily dominant part of the British economy in ways which I think are problematic. Everybody tells me it's a problem. You know, how do you change the balance of economic power in Britain away from finance and away from London? Because what that does is not only mean that there's a weaker industrial strategy in Britain, and there always has been weak industrial strategies, I think. City of London always comes first. Interestingly, Paul mentioned that point. The other problem with the City of London is it distorts everything else in the UK. I mean, just take one simple thing, house prices in the United Kingdom. They're falling everywhere except, guess where, London and the South East. So it creates a greater economic gap. So I think it has all sorts of problems. Paul, do you want to come on?
Well, the City of London is a curiosity, but it is the main driver of economic policy. We have to remember that, you know, the UK, the seventh largest economy in the world by purchasing power parity, sixth by nominal gross domestic product, and much of that is affected by the dominance of the city. The advantage of it is it creates an enormous amount of tax return. We have a big debate that we don't get enough of the tax from financial services, but it creates one. But it creates employment fast. So the two things that the UK economy has done recently, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, retail and financial services, because they can expand very, very quickly and create jobs fast. The downside, of course, is they can lose those jobs very, very fast. Whereas deindustrialization takes quite a long time. It's painful, but it's stretched over a period. So those economic facts are very, very important for the city. But the political influence of the city is also enormous. I mean, a lot of people have talked about it. It's sort of dangerous influence in a way. It's so powerful in terms of directing policy. We did see some of this in the shift in support, a curious shift in support by the city for the Labour Party following the turn towards Euroscepticism of the Conservatives in the 1990s. The so-called Labour charm offensive was the doors were actually thrown open. Nick is quite right, you know, the city won't campaign for staying in Europe, but they will make sure that happens.
Yeah.
And because of that, the UK will stay in the European Union on some terms. They are just enormously powerful. They're not all bad.
No,
the City of London is a corporation.
I know.
Corporation of the City of London is the oldest democratic element of our constitution.
Let me think.
Free men of the city had votes in electing the corporation.
Yeah, my argument against the city is not against the city, is that I think it creates a fantastic distortion in Britain. I find it creates an enormous, in a sense, I mean, I love London, but don't get me wrong, but it has this great sucking, it's a great octopus sucking, you know, talent and ability, you know, from all other parts of the United Kingdom. Actually, in this sense, I think the French have got a much, even though it's always said France is a very centralized polity, very centralized political system, I think France has got a much better set regional balance. I mean, you've got great regional cities in France. I mean, Toulouse, Bordeaux, you know, you go right around the place. London so over-dominates this, and it is to do with this comparative advantage of the city, because the city was based on trade and, you know, London being the great centre of empire. You know, it was the largest port, the largest working port in the world until the late 1950s. You know, bigger than anything in America, and certainly bigger than anything in Asia. So, yeah. Okay.
Another question.
Any other questions?
Yes, of course there are.
Come on.
You can't be so shy. So, do you agree with everything we've said? Okay, good, man.
Yeah, Professor Cox. Yeah. Return to your the word ranking about universities.
Oh yes.
Is it possible, you know, partially because English is still the dominant language in the world. So I suppose if it changes to another, you know, Asian language, the
which language are you thinking of?
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting thing happening in the States. The parents, they start to teach their children Chinese.
Yeah.
The one reason is they want their children to be able to speak to their debt collectors in the future.
Well, as long as they learn English first, we're okay.
Yeah.
I'll pass to Paul on that one, on the world rankings on universities. Look, there's some areas where American universities, America does very badly actually in education, at high school level. There's all sorts of problems at the high school level. In terms of mathematics, on quantitative areas, in South Korea, Japan, China, there's much better, there's no question. And if you look at some of the public schools in America, you'd understand why. Some of them are just absolutely, you know, a disaster. And in fact, this very moment, the United States, very interesting at that level,
the United States is now going through a whole debate about how to renovate and rejuvenate its high schools, you know, from the age of 5 up to about 15 before university. Condoleezza Rice, you may have heard of, who was the Secretary of State under George, is actually leading, has just published an important report from the Council on Foreign Relations on this whole problem of what's going on at the lower level, particularly in literacy and things like that, and areas like mathematics. The basic level of skilling, literacy, and social skills produced by the public school system in America is highly problematic. I'm not saying it's all bad, but I think there are, at a higher level, we call universities, higher education. I'll be pushed on the statistics. I can't remember them all exactly. But what I did was to go through it and say that you take the top 100, you still ended up, by whatever criteria you use, about 40, 48 or something like that, 48 in universities, being US. And we know, why 115,000 students from the People's Republic of China go and study, you know, in the United States? I mean, you know, there have been many things wrong with the American education system, but clearly they're doing quite rather right, particularly when members of the Politburo were sending their children there. But come on, let's be honest about this. And it's equally true of people coming. And the advantage is partly linguistic, it is partly language, you're quite right on that. This is why Australia and Canada do quite well as well in this. So there's an English language advantage. Now, will another language replace English? I personally, and I've got to be very careful here because it will sound very English, won't it? I think it's quite difficult to think of Mandarin becoming a dominant language internationally in the way that English has become the dominant language internationally. I think it will become a more popular language because people want to do business in China, first and foremost, and China is becoming more influential in the world. And power and language go together. And so from that point of view, you know, you will find more and more people wanting to learn Mandarin. I'm not sure it will linguistically come to replace English, because I think English has already established itself, you know, pretty firmly within the business community and the academic world and else, and in international institutions very much so. But I don't know, Paul may have a different take on that.
I perhaps really bring Nick and Catherine in on this one before we start pontificating about global languages. And
I'm going to talk about one language.
Yeah. Well, let me just sort of roll back a bit. If you look at the global lingua franca for higher education in the early part of the 20th century, it was German. There's nothing natural about English being the language of higher education. If you were serious in the natural sciences, you had to learn German. And my father-in-law did chemistry at Oxford. It was compulsory to take a paper in German. He had the advantage of being a refugee who already spoke German. But it was required, because you couldn't do natural science unless you could read the journals, and the journals were German. So Mick is quite right. If you look at the Times Higher Education ranking now, it's certainly dominated by Anglophone. But NUS is rising, Vedar is rising, Hong Kong University is rising. Now that's only three, and Asia is huge, and there are thousands of universities. But I wouldn't want to put a lot of money on 30 years' time, the West having quite, I think there will be a shift back. Now whether that means that Harvard will be the eighth best university in the world behind leading Chinese universities, Stanford is displaced by Fudan or whatever, I wouldn't want to predict. But I just think that anyone who's serious about the future of higher education has to look at the opportunities, but also the challenges that are posed by the rise of Asia. And Mick is retired. I haven't yet retired. I'm rather more cautious about that. And my son has decided that the future is to learn Chinese.
Yeah, okay. There's a debate to be had there, I think. Yeah.
So I have a question for both Professor. Following the comment you mentioned about London is very dominant, I'd like to have your view on the Scotland going to vote for independence next year.
Right.
How that will impact independence?
Well, I've got a lot of things to say about that. If I were living in Scotland, I would be very tempted until now to vote for the Scottish National Party, for the SNP. The reason I would vote for the SNP is that I'm middle class. And in Scotland, if you're born in Scotland, you pay very, hardly anything, four to tell me the figures, to send your kids to universities. You pay much less for medical. So, you know, you have still, I don't know what you would call it for, it's a kind of social democracy, still a social democracy in Scotland, where everything, of course, has become much more marketized in the UK. So you know, I can actually, and SNP is also led by a very clever politician, Alex Salmond, who's, everybody says, is the most brilliant politician in the United Kingdom, which probably tells you a lot about the level of politics in Britain. Will Scotland go independent? Well, I'll follow Paul on that one, never say never. Is it likely? I think not. Why do I think it's not likely? I'll leave it, part of the answer to Paul. Part of it is because the Scots are very intelligent people, and if they're dumb enough to think that going independent is going to solve their economic problems, then I don't know the Scots any longer. You know, very canny, pragmatic people. They've already got a parliament, which gives them an enormous degree of control over many areas of legislation. So they can hardly claim that they're being discriminated against. It's not like the 16th or 17th century, you know. But it is an interesting phenomenon. One might ask us, what if Scotland were to go independent? It's kind of hypothetical, I know. I think it's unlikely they will for economic reasons, and when they have to go in and vote yes or no, I think the majority will probably vote no. But there is a what-if question. What really then happens to the United Kingdom if Scotland goes independent? Because although Scotland has a population of about 5 million, the constitutional and political ramifications, and then of course Britain's position in Europe would also be affected. Just before wanting to pick up something.
Well, firstly, Scotland aren't going to vote for independence. I mean, a prediction, but I can say with a huge amount of confidence.
Can we remember this tonight?
Yes. the nationalists will do very, very well in a referendum. But think of Quebec. Quebec nationalism is very much about control of its domestic policy, and you get frequent votes for the Parti Québécois against the rest of Canada. Once they're asked the independence question, they step back. So they want autonomy, they want to be their own government, but they don't really want to make that last step. And my strong feeling is that that is the way Scotland will go. But a couple of observations. One of the things that Salmond has said in order to soften the argument for independence, but may curiously indicate something different, is he says that in the event of becoming independent, they would keep the pound. Now, the one consequence of that would be that their monetary policy would no longer be in their power. So to have sovereignty but not have control over your own monetary policy is not to have sovereignty. In other words, they would not have representation on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, they wouldn't be entitled to it, they couldn't claim it, they would be the victim of a transnational central bank. Now, you know, maybe that says that they're happy with Europe doing that, but that's not independence of the sort that's the rest. But the other interesting thing is, it might be the lifeline that the UK Conservative Party needs if Scotland were to vote almost for independence, but not fully for independence. It's not inconceivable that the consequence of Scotland agreeing to stay in the Union is the Conservatives give them a huge amount of additional discretionary powers, perhaps tax-raising powers, and so on and so forth, everything short of full sovereignty, in return for the reduction of Scottish representation in the Westminster Parliament. Now, who's the strongest party in Scotland? It's the UK Labour Party. If you took Labour seats Scottish Labour seats out of, or massively reduced the number in Parliament, the Conservatives would have an inbuilt majority. So it is quite possible for Cameron, and remember, you know, this was done with Northern Ireland. You stay in the Union, you have your own Parliament, you get on with it, but the Union is saved. A Conservative can do that. We've done it before. And the consequence of that is to save the Conservatives from the other problems that I was talking about. If Cameron is wise, and he may not be, but he's not a stupid man, he may see a real opportunity here. And I think that's more likely to be the kind of issue in British politics than the question of what happens if Scotland were to decide to completely secede. They're just not going to do it, but they may come close.
I've got a question for both professors. So I thought the topic about Europe needs to find its role. I think it's very interesting. But I just wondered why hasn't it found its role? And if, because we're talking Europe as a very collective term, but it's not. So if the national interests come into that, whether that's ever achievable or not, and if it is achievable, so what kind of steps, what kind of direction, and who's going to make the decision collectively?
Let me turn the question back. I mean, one response to Mick's original observation is to say, in what way has Europe not found its role? Perhaps Europe has found its role in, you know, Europe has done colonialism, Europe has done imperialism, Europe has been the site of two major wars, the long European Civil War that I talked about. You know, we've done other things. The European Union is one institutional manifestation, possibly, of a way of Europe seeking its place in the world without all of those things. So the idea that what Europe needs to do is to become a new kind of imperial power, I just don't think that's the way to think about it. Its trade relations, and Mick's quite right, you know, it is still the most significant single market globally. It is a global partner that China needs and wants. It's a global partner that the United States needs and wants. Think of Barack Obama's brief intervention and a curious intervention into British politics to actually allow an important member of his government to say the US would like Britain to stay a central member of the European plot. That's a very rare kind of intervention. So my sense is that Europe has found its role. It's a quiet role. It's an important role, and it's a trading role. And given that we haven't had, apart from the Balkans, which is left over business from 1945, you know, we've done rather well by European standards in not being a source of disorder and instability and chaos and war for everywhere else. Over the last 60-something years.
Yeah, I would go along with that most of the way. I'd just add one or two things. Firstly, on the broad look at Europe historically, and Paul is absolutely right. Take Europe in 1914. Take Europe in the interwar period between First and Second World War, and take Europe by 1945. What did we do? Two world wars, one world depression, the killing of 6 million Jews, the creation of fascism, and Stalinism, if you want to throw the Soviet Union into it as well. There's not a great historical record. Plus, we were trying to hang on to all our European empires at the same time, as you remember, and the British more than anybody else. Though the French were pretty good at it too. So, you know, there's not an ideal European past. And so therefore looking at the Europe that was imperialist, colonial, racist, warlike, and killing about 130 million people of its own, well, that's a pretty bad record. So if we compare that Europe with the Europe that we've seen since the end of World War II, and certainly since the end of the Cold War, when Europe was finally reunited and Germany was reunited.
Without violence. without violence. Yeah, and I mean, look at the prosperity, look at the democracy that was created. It's been a remarkable last 50, 60 years. What I find depressing about British politics is that very few people in political life will stand up and say what I just said. They won't stand up and say. They won't say what a mess Europe was before and how the European, what I call the European vision, has done to contribute so much to not the only thing, but a fundamental part of the resolution of Europe's problems. And look at the way Europe managed to take itself through the end of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War could have ended very badly. Could have ended very badly. But it didn't. And the one tragedy of the end of the Cold War, at least in Europe, and I'm talking Europe, not Asia now, but you know, the great tragedy in Europe, of course, what happened to former Yugoslavia. So, in that sense, I pick up on Paul's really big point, that, you know, Europe found its role, making peace within itself, stopping being colonial.
Shopping.
Shopping, too, but people do that better in China than anywhere in the world, I think. So it's not a peculiarly Chinese thing, a peculiarly European thing. But, you know, the role has been made. And the role was first and foremost in Europe, and it's been the promoter of some pretty good values, in my view, human rights, regional cooperation, and trying to do international relations differently as a model. And I think all of those things need to be talked about, shouted about, without being in any way chauvinist about it. My concern is not peculiarly a British concern, I think it's a European concern. As I said in my presentation, firstly, so much of the focus over the last 5 years, I think, Paul, has been on what's wrong with Europe and not what's right with Europe and what the achievements are in Europe. And secondly, I think that nobody at the moment is prepared to tell the positive story about Europe and its vision. The final thing I'd end on saying is that although this is a very deep crisis in Europe, there's no doubt about the problems it is facing. These are the sovereign debt funds, the austerity program, the levels of unemployment. This is, I think, I'd be careful, but it's certainly one of the biggest crises Europe has ever confronted. There's no doubt about that, and it's going to take a lot of effort to get out of this mess that we're currently in. Although this mess began, by the way, back in the United States in 2008, and let's go back to the original financial crisis. But when we get out of this, this is where I feel the role does expand, and this is where I slightly disagree with Paul a little bit. But I think I think Europe speaks with a better voice when it speaks with one voice. I do think that, yeah. Because we're going to live in a world basically of what I would call, let's put it bluntly, two superpowers. You guys are going to be one of them, and the Americans are going to be the other one largely. Okay, that's going to be the world. You know, I think there's a lot of nonsense talk about China, and I've often polemicized against people who exaggerate. And, you know, I think there's a lot of rubbish to come up with. The China threat, and, you know, China taking the world over. One day China will rule the world. I just don't believe any of that. But I think in the world we're going to live in, China's going to be a much bigger actor. And America's going to remain a dominant player in this world. Don't underestimate all this talk about American decline, forget it. In that world, a Europe which is not talking with a voice just doesn't sound so credible. It won't sound so credible. I mean, a France with 50, 60 million people, even a Germany with 80 million, it doesn't sound the same. And this is why I concluded, you know, optimistically, I hope, that, you know, Europe's still unfinished business. You know, we're on a path, and I think that path must lead somewhere else. I think that will lead to a wider role for Europe. Because I don't think we can do it as separate nations. In a world of 1.3 billion active and productive people from China, and what would be 400 million high productive Americans, you know, so, who have spent half the world's expenditures on military power and who are still remain a major player in the world. You know, Europe has to be, to me, you know, that third player in that world. And if it isn't that, then the future would be more problematic.
Very good. Well, I think we leave it there. Please give the discussion the
Paul and I now have our disagreements in public. You want aircraft carriers for Europe too, do you?
No, I was just going to make the observation that it's still... Sorry.
carrying on.
We're carrying on. Sit down.
It carries on from Mick's point about, you know, America's military power.
Yeah.
When I was arranging this trip to come out, I spoke to my father. My father came to, I've come from Singapore to Hong Kong, here and then up to my father said, oh yes, I went to Singapore on an aircraft carrier. He went to Hong Kong on a battleship. He didn't stop here, but he went to Korea, again, on an aircraft carrier.
Mm.
It wasn't that long ago that Britain's naval power was still enormous. Within 15 or 20 years, that had completely gone. It's just history. Now, I'm not saying that the US is going exactly the same way, but to maintain that level of military projection is a diversion from other things states want to do. Europe has learned that. I think the United States is starting to learn that, and they will stay a major power, but there are other things they will want to do with their resources than just build aircraft carriers. I think President Obama is aware of that. It takes time to shift.
Yeah, okay, we can have a great argument now. I think the United States will not stop spending a very large amount of its money on its military projected power. And anybody who lives in Asia has heard the term Asia, the pivot to Asia, which you wanted me to mention. I think America will continue to project its power in all sorts of ways. The question is how people respond to that projection. It actually, in terms of its GNP, it can afford it. It can afford it, don't worry.
Not indefinitely.
Not indefinitely, but forever. How's that?
not while Europe and China enjoys shopping.
Well, okay. On the shopping word, I think we'll end. Thank you very much indeed, everyone. Thank you.